entitled The Killing of Keishi and Fiyoma. Please repeat. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're going to begin on text number 25, and we will complete the chapter today. And there's no purports, so we will repeat the first verse together. I'll say, you say. Bhagavan Api Govindo.
Bhagavan
Api Govindo.
Atva
Keshinam Ahave. Atva Keshinam Ahave. Pashun Apalayat Palai. Pashun Apalayat Palai. Triptev Raja Sukhavaha. Trittar Raja Sukhavaha. Bhagavan Api Govindo. Atva Keshinam Ahave. Pashun Apalayat Palai. Trittar Raja Sukhavaha. Please chant. Word for word synonyms, please repeat. Bhagavan, the Supreme Lord. Api, and Govinda,
Govinda.
Hatva, having killed.
Keshinam,
the demon Keshi. Ahave, in battle. Pashun, the animals. Apalayat, he tended. Palai, together with the cowherd boys. Pritai, who were pleased. Vraja, to the inhabitants of Vrindavan. Sukha, happiness. Avaha, bringing. Translation. After killing the demon Keshi in battle, the Supreme Personality of Godhead continued to tend the cows and other animals in the company of his joyful cowherd boyfriends. Thus he brought happiness to all the residents of Vrindavan. 26. One day, the cowherd boys, while grazing their animals on the mountain slopes, played the game of stealing and hiding, acting out the roles of rival thieves and herders. 27. In that game, O king, some acted as thieves, others as shepherds, and others as sheep. They played their game happily, without fear of danger. 28. A powerful magician named Vyoma, son of the demon Maya, then appeared on the scene in the guise of a cowherd boy. Pretending to join the game as a thief, he proceeded to steal most of the cowherd boys who were acting as sheep. 29. Gradually, the great demon abducted more and more of the cowherd boys and cast them into a mountain cave, which he sealed shut with a boulder. Finally, only 4 or 5 boys acting as sheep remained in the game. 30. Lord Krishna, who shelters all saintly devotees, understood perfectly well what Vyomasura was doing. Just as a lion grabs a wolf, Krishna forcefully seized the demon as he was taking away more cowherd boys. 31. The demon changed into his original form, as big and powerful as a great mountain. But try as he might to free himself, he could not do so, having lost his strength from being held in the Lord's tight grip. 32. Lord Achyuta clutched Vyomasura between his arms and threw him to the ground. Then, while the demigods in heaven looked on, Krishna killed him in the same way that one kills a sacrificial animal. One sentence purport. The acharyas inform us that sacrificial animals were killed by means of strangulation. Here it says, in this verse, that Krishna killed Vyomasura just as sacrificial animals are killed. In the Krishna book, it says that Krishna killed Vyomasura in the same way that animals are killed in a slaughterhouse. Here, apparently the acharyas say the animal was strangled. I suppose that wasn't done by the Brahmins. There must be other people assisting in the sacrifice, because my understanding is that Brahmins cannot do like such violent things. They were chanting the mantras. So anyway, no more insight on that one. 33. Krishna then smashed the boulder blocking the cave's entrance and led the trapped cowherd boys to safety. Thereafter, as the demigods and cowherd boys sang his glories, he returned to his cowherd village, Gokula. Thus end the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 10th canto, 37th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Killing of the Demons, Keshi and Vyoma. Tomorrow we'll start on chapter 38. Om Jnana Timirandasya Kiranjana Shavakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So when I read Srimad Bhagavatam, I like to look at it from the angle of a brand new person who's just coming in contact with Srila Prabhupada's books. If somebody were to... Is anybody here for the very first time, brand new person? No. If somebody were to sit in this room this morning as a person just being introduced to Krishna consciousness, they've met a Hare Krishna devotee out in the public, and that devotee has persuaded this person to come to the temple to hear Bhagavatam class in the morning, because after all, we have the highest philosophy, we have the highest theology. You will never find any book, any tradition in the world that has such intricate, deep, meaningful philosophy and theology. So the person comes to class today, and they've been attentively listening to the recitation of this pastime. What are they going to be thinking? I just came to the Hare Krishna temple to hear some sublime philosophy. And what have I heard? I've heard a children's story. Once upon a time, Krishna and the boys went to the forest to play games. They were playing cowherds, or, you know, herders and sheep and thieves, and they dressed themselves up as thieves and sheep and herders, and a big demon came, and he stole the sheep and the cow. You know, the person's going to be thinking, what? Next thing you know, they're going to be passing out the coloring books. You know, so where is the philosophy? This is the 10th canto. But we should understand it. Yes, this Srimad Bhagavatam states right in the very beginning that don't be bewildered. This Srimad Bhagavatam, Nigama Kalpataro Galitam Phalam, it is the mature, ripened fruit of the desire tree of Vedic literature. This is nothing less than that. And this 10th canto is the pinnacle. Why? What is the 10th canto? The 10th canto is illustrating what is the perfection of Uttama Bhakti. So we know that there's many stages in the progression of the devotee's advancement on the path of Uttama Bhakti. Uttama Bhakti means pure bhakti, bhakti which is solely and wholly for Krishna, free of material motives, etc., etc., not mixed with anything else. So there's 9 stages in that progression. So the first 7 stages, Shraddha, which is faith, Sarusanga, association of devotees, Bhajna Kriya, the practice of devotional principles. 4, Anartana Vritti, the actual stage of cleansing the unwanted things from the heart. 5, Nishtha, the steadiness in devotion, no more big distractions. 6, Ruchi, or actual affinity for bhakti. These 7, did we get all 7? Oh, and asakti, sorry, number 7. Asakti then is not just affinity, but attachment. Total attachment. Like, attachment means it's stuck, right? It can't be removed. Attachment for bhakti. These 7 stages are in the category of sadhana, or devotion in practice. So these first 7 steps are bhakti in practice. It's the ways and the means and the process of bhakti. But the final 2 steps, bhava, which means one actually experiences ecstatic emotions due to their starting to realize what their rasa with Krishna is, that's bhava bhakti. And then 9th, prema, one actually gets reciprocation personally from Krishna in the stage of prema bhakti. So these 2, bhava and prema, constitute what's called not sadhana, but sadhya. That's the objective of sadhana. So these 7 steps of sadhana lead us to sadhya, or the objective. Those devotees who are in those 2 platforms, bhava and prema, they're the uttama bhaktas. That's what uttama bhakta means. And it's only with these devotees that Krishna performs his nitya lila, whether it's the road show or what have you in the material world. Only with these devotees does Krishna perform his lila. So, Prabhupada says in the first chapter of the 10th canto, it's the 23rd verse, he says that in Bhagavad Gita 4.9, the Lord says, Jaktvadeham punar janma naiti mam eti. After giving up the material body, the devotee of the Lord returns home, back to Godhead. This means that the devotee is first transferred to the particular universe where the Lord is at that time staying to exhibit his pastimes. So, first there's sadhana, the seven steps of sadhana. Then there's the two steps of sadhya. And devotees in that category can take birth on the planet where Krishna's having his pastimes to get their last little remnants of training, of perfection. Then, after doing that in the sadhya stage, then one goes to Goloka. Unless the Lord, of course, wants that devotee to stay here and engage in his roadshow. So this is the progression. Sadhana, sadhya, and then Goloka. So, what does this progression through the nine steps actually entail? We would like to progress through the nine steps, right? We all want to go back to Godhead, we say. So how do we progress through these nine steps? What is this progression? This progression through the nine steps actually involves the progressive, gradual eradication of doubts. Doubts are the foundation of all anartas. Any anarta you can think of, its foundation is doubts. Doubt means I don't fully know something, right? Someone gives me a cup of water. Well, I don't know that that's water that I should drink. Maybe there's some poison in it. I don't know that it's okay to drink. Okay, that was a nice person, like I trust them maybe. So I have faith and I trust that this water is pure, they're not trying to kill me. But I don't know until I experience it. So our faith, whether it's in a person or Krishna or whatever, will always be tinged by some doubt. Unless and until we experience that thing, then we can be free from doubt. So these doubts are the greatest obstacle on the path of progressive devotional service. So in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna that these doubts that are haunting you, they have to be slashed. They have to be annihilated. And how do you annihilate such doubts? He says, with the weapon of knowledge. Now this knowledge, of course, doesn't mean mundane knowledge. It means transcendental knowledge. And what does transcendental knowledge mean? Ultimately, transcendental knowledge means full realization of what is my unique personal relationship with Krishna. That's full-blown transcendental knowledge. But transcendental knowledge begins with the understanding of sambandha. Theoretical understanding, what is the relationship between the jiva and God? And then understanding abhideya, that how should one act in that relationship? And then knowledge of prayojana, that, well, what does that fruit of that relationship look like? What does that love for Krishna look like? So we start off with this theoretical transcendental knowledge. To the extent that our knowledge is theoretical, to that extent, our doubts don't get very much eradicated. To the extent that our knowledge is realized, it's vijnana rather than just jnana, to that extent, our doubts can get eradicated. So it behooves us to move through the stages of bhakti to get that realized knowledge. So Prabhupada said that doubts are always compared to demons. They're always compared to demons. So now the question would be, at what stage are we free from doubts? Sometimes we think we're free from doubts, but at what stage? There's a science to it. So Krishna actually indicates this in the Bhagavad Gita at the very start of the 7th chapter. He says, Maya sakta mana parta yogam yunjam manashraya asamshayam samagram mam yata gyasyasi tachchinu. Just hear, Arjuna, about how you can practice this system of bhakti in full consciousness of me with your mind fully attached to me and become completely in knowledge of me. You can know me in truth, in full, free from all doubts. My asakta mana parta. Asakta, asakti. Asakti means that stage of attachment to bhakti and the object of bhakti, Krishna. So here he's indicating in 7.1 of Bhagavad Gita, my asakta mana parta. When you engage in devotional service with your mind completely attached to me, then you can know me in full, free from all doubts. While we're practicing bhakti on the 6 lower stages, that those 6 that are before asakti, in those stages, we cannot know Krishna in full, free from all doubts. That means we're haunted by doubts. And what do doubts cause us to do? If you have a doubt about something, what does it cause you to do? I have a doubt lingering in the back of my mind. You're a nice person. You gave me this beautiful cup of water. But still, there's a tiny little doubt in there about whether there's some poison in it. So what does it cause me to do?
You can't be attached to it.
Well, I can't be attached to it, but how does that act out in... I hesitate. I don't guzzle down the water, do I? If there's a doubt about that person's character, about the purity of the water, I'm not going to put it on my tongue. I'll hesitate. We do that all the time, right? We don't just have open, intimate relationships with every person on the planet. It takes a long time to get, what's your name, where are you from? You check the person out and graduate, because there's so much doubts about, especially these days, right? Golly, the nicest looking old lady on the street can be a mass murderer, right? So there's the doubts cause us to hesitate. So this is why we're feeling so much hesitation in our surrender to Krishna, because there's doubts. So Krishna then is telling Arjuna, you have to come to the stage of asakti to be free of all doubts. You must. Otherwise, we're not going to know Krishna in full. So, what does that state of asakti look like? So, Bhagavatam, 2nd canto, illustrates the stage of asakti by saying, Evam prasana manaso bhagavad bhakti yogataha. Bhagavat tasya vijnana mukta sangasya jayate, that in the stage of asakti, one's risen from the stage of ruchi, they're completely situated in the mode of goodness, unalloyed goodness, their mind is totally happy. In that stage where one reaches asakti then, one gets scientific understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Scientific understanding means experience. In this stage of asakti, it said, mukta sangasya jayate, that scientific, experiential understanding of Krishna is born from this stage of asakti where one is mukta sangasya, free from all material association, which means free from all doubts. That's what asakti looks like. Free from all doubts, scientific realization of the Lord. So this is the stage one must come to. And how does one come to that stage? Well, there's so many steps before that, but the catalyst is Shushusho Shradhanasya Vasudeva Katavuchi Syan Mahat Sevaya Vipra Punyatirtana Shevanat. One must serve. One must seek out the association of that devotee who is himself or herself completely free from all doubts. By serving that devotee who is completely free of all vice, or completely free from all doubts, that's the greatest vice, to have doubts about Krishna. Find that devotee who's completely free of all vice, render service unto that devotee. Especially hear, that's the most important, hear from such a devotee, hear their realizations. By hearing from that devotee, serving that devotee, that's the catalyst. And that's always the catalyst. It's not that we do that for some time and then we drop that because now I'm on the stage of nishta. I don't need that anymore. No, that's the catalyst which takes us from step one to step two to step three, all the way through anarta nivritti, nishta, ruchi, asakti, and forward. That catalyst can never be abandoned. The reaction won't go forward. So, being doubt-free is the goal of the devotee. Many people are concerned about being debt-free in their life, right? Or having, you know, sugar-free food or whatever. Being doubt-free is the stage that we must come to. So, while we're in the material world, even if a devotee comes to the stage of sadhya, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti, even in those stages, when one has graduated from asakti and is free from all doubts, there will always remain an aroma, if you will, of some minuscule residual doubts that remain in the consciousness of the devotee while one is still in the material world. In the Madhurya Kandambani, it says that due to nam aparad, due to nam aparad committed in the past, and we all commit nam aparads, well, we're not chanting Shuddha Nam. Due to nam aparads, even the devotee who's in the stages of bhava or prema will have residual anartas remaining in their heart. And that must be removed before they can go to Goloka. Therefore, we have to take birth where Krishna is having his nitya lila in the material world to go there. So here in the 10th canto, Krishna is appearing to enact lila with his sadhya devotees. And what is he doing? He's killing the demons. Well, who are those demons? They represent, each and every demon, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, represents different doubts and their corresponding anartas. The anarta is like the gross manifestation of the doubt. The doubt is the underlying subtle form of the anarta. So Krishna personally comes to eradicate that last residual aroma of doubt remaining in the consciousness of the devotee. It's not something we do on our own. We can't do that work. The devotee simply surrenders to Krishna, and Krishna does the work. So, in this way, our new guest, who was doubting their attendance in Bhagavatam class, that it just sounds like children's stories. In this way, we can explain Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest theological and philosophical work in this material world, because it's showing us the progressive stages on the path of Uttama Bhakti. Where else do you get that? What other tradition in the world gives you a scientific process to gain perfection? It also, Bhagavatam also illustrates the incompleteness of things like Mishra Bhakti, or mixed bhakti, bhakti which is mixed with jnana, karma, yoga, etc. There's instances, stories throughout the Bhagavatam of persons who were not practicing Uttama Bhakti. They were practicing some Mishra Bhakti, and therefore they didn't reach perfection. Bhagavatam also illustrates the pitfalls on the path of Uttama Bhakti. What kind of obstacles are we going to encounter? And how do devotees successfully or not successfully overcome those obstacles? So Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest philosophy because it's giving us the process and it's fully illustrating the objective to the point of the pinnacle of the 10th canto. So what do we find here in the 10th canto? Here we find devotees who have fully and solely surrendered to Krishna. And due to that surrender, Krishna is personally coming to eradicate any threat of any kind of demons that could possibly jeopardize the bhakti of the devotee. We have examples like the cowherd boys in the pastime of the snake Agasura. Agasura. What happened when Agasura came? The cowherd boys thought, oh, this appears to be a very ferocious snake, poisonous snake. But then they thought, no, actually, I think it's just a cave. And, you know, they were like, what is this? Is this a snake? Is this a cave? And then they concluded, oh, it's a cave, and we can play on it. And they were taking their ropes and climbing the teeth of Agasura like they were mountain peaks, and sliding up and down his tongue, and like it's a water park or something. And then at one point, it was obvious that Agasura wanted to swallow them. So at first they hesitated, but then one of the cowherd boys said, what? What are we hesitating? Krishna's right there. There's no danger. Even if this is a big poisonous snake, so what? Krishna's going to save us anyway. So what's the problem? So, okay, so they just marched right into Agasura's mouth. Let's go for an adventure. And there they went. Big poisonous snake swallowed them up. But they had no fear. That means they had no doubt. What didn't they have doubt in? They did not have any doubt that their cute little boyfriend named Krishna, even though they had no idea that he was God, but they had complete faith that this, their most lovable friend, Krishna, would totally save them if there was any danger. Yet other personalities in the Bhagavatam didn't have such faith. You know, we have people like, you know, story of Lord Brahma. When he saw Krishna manifesting so many wonderful leelas and little miracles here and there, he was like, who is this boy Krishna? I'm the Lord of the universe. I'm the powerful one. He had doubts about Krishna's position, identity. So then he did his little trick of stealing the cows and putting them in the caves, the calves, right? Because he had to test Krishna's powers. We have Indra, you know, when Krishna was convincing Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd men not to do the Indra Yajna and to instead worship Govardhan, he got very upset. Who is this talkative little boy named Krishna? He again doubted Krishna's position. Why did they doubt Krishna's position, even though they're big, big demigods? Because Krishna came as this beautiful, cute little cowherd boy with no weapons, no big army behind him, submissive to his parents, henpecked by the gopis. You know, how is that God? You know, maybe if he had four arms and weapons and, you know, fire coming out of his mouth or something, then I could accept him as God. So these doubts were there in both Lord Brahma's and Lord Indra's minds because they couldn't accept that such a cute little cowherd boy could be God. And we probably harbor those doubts a little bit too, or a lot. One time when Jadurani Devi painted a picture of Krishna killing Kamsa in the wrestling arena, she showed the painting to Prabhupada. And he said, "No, no, no, no. What have you done? You have painted Krishna with muscles." He said, "Krishna doesn't have muscles. He has tender limbs." Repaint it. So then she repainted it with Kamsa with the big muscles and Krishna with the dainty little limbs. So our mind is like that. We can't accept this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So little doubts like this can linger to the very end of our devotional service. So our whole path in devotional service is an eradication of doubts. Krishna comes to kill those demons of doubts, and all we have to do is let him do that. We can't get in the way and put up our own like defense system. So we are all going to be tested. None of us can go back to Godhead until our hearts are completely free of all doubts. We will all be tested. And those tests will come in very, very different ways. And often the test is disguised. You don't realize that you're going through a test because Krishna wants to see where you are on the platform of doubts. We have to be tested. If the teacher never tests the student will not go forward. So Krishna, if we're serious, sincere devotees, Krishna will always put tests on in our life to measure where our level of doubts is. And when those doubts come, or when those, I should say, challenges come, we should welcome them with open arms, that this is an opportunity for me to exercise my level of freedom from doubts. It's an opportunity for me to get rid of some more doubts. And those challenges can come in many different ways. We might have financial challenges. We might have social challenges. We might have health challenges. And of course, the final exam of life. Death will come. And when death comes, and it can come very unexpectedly, in the most bizarre way that you never thought of, you know, when you weren't prepared. When death comes, of ourselves, of a loved one, of whatever, we have to pass that test of being completely free from all doubt. We have to understand anything that's happening is simply Krishna's loving caress on the devotee, and he's doing it out of real love for the devotee because he wants to remove the last residual aromas of doubt that come to haunt the devotee while they're in this material world. So this is what the Association of Devotees is all about, to help each other be free of doubts by sharing our realizations together and especially reading Srimad Bhagavatam together, the Krishna book together, because each and every chapter where Krishna is killing the demons has the potency to uproot those doubts and anartas that are associated with that demon. So let's take advantage of association with devotees and reach that final perfectional stage of bhakti. So So we will stop there and see if there's any discussion by the assembled devotees.
You mentioned that when there is suffering, that's a test, and that's the place to get rid of our doubts. You didn't, I guess, in the interest of time, perhaps clarify what the mechanism would be, you know, how that would work. So it seems counterintuitive. Somebody has suffering, we say, well, why is Krishna doing this to me? So actually it gives rise to more doubts, it seems, it gets rid of them.
So, okay, nice question. So when some challenge comes, we have to see what we're doing. Look in the mirror. Look in the mirror and record every word that you're saying. When challenges come, do we see ourselves saying like that? Oh, Krishna, why are you doing this to me? Why are you abandoning me? Why are you giving me this suffering? Why are you challenging me? This is why do we say something's bad in this world? There's nothing good and there's nothing bad in this world. It is a mental concoction. I think it's good when I give birth to a beautiful baby, healthy baby. But I think it's bad if my 3-year-old son gets, you know, an illness and dies. Why? Why do we say the birth is good and the death of the child is bad? It's neither good nor bad. It's material. So the mechanism is we have to be honest and analyze ourselves. Okay, maybe we're so neophyte that we can't even analyze ourselves honestly and pull ourselves out of the muck. Associate with devotees. This is the real love between devotees. Loving relationships amongst devotees is not, oh, Prabhu, this terrible thing happened to you. Let me come over and we'll, like, you know, eat cupcakes together and feel better. That's not relationship with devotees. Relationships with devotees is understanding the devotee, letting them go through their, you know, thing, but ultimately coming to the platform of Prabhu. There's some doubts there. Let's talk about this. Let's share our realizations. Let's practice taking shelter of Krishna. That's what the cowherd boys did. We can't imitate. I'm not saying imitate. Don't get me wrong. But we have to emulate. The cowherd boys accepted the fact that the forest fire was going to devour them all. Or they accepted the fact that Agasura was going to swallow them. They did what they could do. And they just, you know, all right, it's up to Krishna. We have to practice that. And we can't practice it on our own. It requires the association of devotees who have themselves gone through challenges and tribulations. And we have to beg for the mercy. Give me the strength to make it through this. It's a rocky road. It's a very muddy road. I'm not probably going to get stuck in it. You know? So we have to beg for that assistance. Krishna, you know, what is it that we actually have doubts in? We have doubts in the power of the holy name. We're not taking shelter of the holy name. You know, what does it mean to take shelter of Krishna or to have faith in Krishna? It means to take shelter of the holy name, to have faith in the holy name. So we have to practice, and we should better practice now before the challenges come so that when the challenges come, our muscles are already built up for it, right? Don't ask me to lift a 100-pound box right now. I haven't practiced lifting 10, 20, 30. So it comes from the association of devotees. Can I try your food?
Your opening remarks about the tenth canto, we should say that's a hypothetical situation because it's not recommended that newcomers hear the tenth canto. So that's more important.
Yes, yes.
I'd like to make. So if we're doing our job properly, that wouldn't situation wouldn't arise. They'd be properly prepped. So I'd like to ask a question about the doubts that you're mentioning. Normally you understand that regularly it's described in the first canto that doubts are eradicated. That's the process of anatta nivritti. But you seem to indicate that they still exist in prema bhakti.
The anartas
are the offenses
that come through nama aparad. According to Madhurya Kandamani, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, that anartas from past pious and past impious activities are eradicated in the stage of anarta nivritti. Anartha, and almost to completely nil, but not completely, completely to nil, absolutely, till like ruchi or asakti. And anarthas that come from our performance of bhakti, you know, like we don't pay obeisances properly, we make aparads to the deities, whatever. Right. Seva aparad, those also get eradicated 100% absolutely before the stage of bhava. But anarthas that come from namaparad, those linger all the way through the stage of prema and aren't completely absolutely annihilated until one reaches the lotus feet of Krishna. And what my point was that anarthas are due to doubts. They're the effect of doubts. Why do we commit namaparad? Because there's some lingering doubt about the holy name. You know, so doubts are like the subtle form, and anarthas are the reaction or the gross manifestation of that doubt that we harbored in the past.
Doubt and sin are synonymous?
Not synonymous. Like, I have a doubt about the quality of this water, so then the anartha, this is an analogy, so the doubt is about the quality of this water, and the anartha is, I'm not going to drink that water. Like, I refuse the water. You know, so doubts are the underlying foundation of anarthas. Anarthas means we're attached to things, we have bad habits, we're attached to fruitive activities, speculative activities, etc., 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 all due to the underlying doubt of the worthlessness of those things and the perfect value of Krishna and the path of bhakti, uttama bhakti. So ultimately, we can trace all our anarthas to some underlying doubt. That's why Krishna says they're like demons. They have to be killed. They have to be killed. So anarthas are like the gross form of doubts. So the doubts are eradicated in the stage of anartha nivritti, but not absolutely eradicated until all the way through prema. So it's pretty heavy.
May I ask another question, please? Normally you understand that Uttama Adhikari doesn't fall down. What was the question? But
Uttama Bhaktas can fall down,
yes,
if they make some maha aparad.
You were making the point that bhava and prema are on the same platform of Uttama. But we have example of someone falling down from bhava. Normally you understand Uttama Adhikari does not fall down.
Normally. The only thing that can make an Uttama Bhakta fall down is a maha aparad. And that's so rare. It's not impossible, but it's very rare. So that's why it said Uttama Bhaktas don't fall down. However, if due to some bizarre situation they were to make some maha aparad, they would fall down. We have the example of, was it Rupa Goswami? Was in meditation, in trance, and a Brahmin walked by. And Rupa was seeing Krishna Leela in his meditation, and something funny happened, so he laughed while he was meditating in bhava. He was on that platform of bhava, that in meditation he was seeing Krishna Leela, and he was laughing because something funny happened in the Leela. Well, while he was doing that, a Brahmin happened to walk by that was kind of ugly looking. And so when he walked by, he sensed incorrectly that Rupa was laughing at him. Because he was used to people laughing at him because he was like ugly, so people laugh at ugly people sometimes. So he thought Rupa Goswami laughed at him, so he took offense. And he just kept walking with a hurt heart, you know. And Rupa, he was in his trance, and all of a sudden, oh no, the transcendental television just lost service. I don't see the Leela anymore. What happened? Oh my God, there's no, what? I must have committed, only aparad can do that. What went wrong? And so then he went to his brother Sanatan. What happened that I lost my trance? I heard only aparad can do that. And then he said, yeah, you did do an aparad. What? There was nobody around to make an aparad to. Well, there was this Brahmin that walked by, and he foolishly thought you laughed at him, but because he misunderstood, he took offense, so you got the reaction. So it can happen.
For the doubting soul, there's no happiness in this life or the next, right?
That's correct.
But it seems like if you're in the highest happiness, you can still have some doubts. Okay.
Therefore, one never considers themselves on the perfect stage. Like I told that story before, that Prabhupada said to the devotees, what's the difference between me and you? The difference is that you can always fall down and I can never fall down. And then they went to greeting the deities. When the devotee saw Prabhupada offering sincere prayers at greeting the deities, late in the day he went to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, what were you praying to the deities? I'd like to pray like that. Prabhupada said, I was simply praying that I may never fall down into Maya. Prabhupada, you told us this morning that you can never fall down into Maya. And that was the difference between me and you, that I can always fall down and you can't fall down. And Prabhupada said, now you know why. Mm-hmm. Now you know why. The Uttama Bhakta is... he's Uttama because he takes perfect shelter of Krishna. Therefore, he can never fall down. But an aparad can make the devotee fall down. But because of their always praying.
Sorry, if no one else wants to help them. I have one more question. Okay.
So yeah, it's dangerous while we're in the material world, even if one's an Uttama Bhakta. And Prabhupada demonstrated that many times by his sincere prayers. Even tears coming out of his eyes, that I pray to Krishna that I may never fall down. He was showing us by his example. And once we give up that, once we have confidence, I've made it. Whew, I don't have to pray anymore. Then we fall down. Prabhu.
I have a doubt about doubts. So so sometimes when we're, I'm making it into a binary, but just to, sometimes when we talk about doubts, it sounds like, you know, it's an ideological exercise where we just sort of get our intellectual little duck pins lined up and then we pick them up and just bash that, you know, odd looking duck pin to get it out off the bowling alley. So, I mean, that intellectual exercise is also there. Even Bhaktisiddhanta says you beat the mind with the whatever's handy. But then there's also an aspect whereby taking up the process of hearing and chanting and dancing and taking association, you purify the heart, and gradually the doubts and the anarthas are removed by just taking up the process and the heart is purified. So how would you bet? I mean, it seems like there's two, perhaps one could think there's two different concepts.
Okay, thank you for your question. Yeah. Yes, let's clarify. Of course, that is one type of doubt. The ideological doubts, that's just one kind of doubt, like when one doubts the philosophy or something. But doubts, in what we were trying to explain, but we'll clarify, doubts means I don't know something. For example, how many of us know what our relationship with Krishna is? We have theoretical knowledge, jivarasarupahoi krishnaranichina. We can say that a billion times. I'm a devotee of Krishna, and so therefore I practice devotional service. So that's faith. I don't know that what my relationship with Krishna is. All I know is I am this body, and this is my relative, and this is my friend, and you know. Knowing means you experience something. So I have faith that that cup of water you gave me is water. So I drink it, but I don't know that it's just pure water, that it doesn't have poison in it, until I actually do it and experience it. So bhakti is, the progress through the nine stages of bhakti is the maturation of faith, which means the eradication of doubts. They're synonymous. As the doubts get eradicated, faith increases. Faith is the opposite of doubts. So I have better faith today than I did when I joined the movement. I remember when I was a new devotee, we'd go to the airport to distribute books, and sometimes I would just stop distributing books, sit on the chair, and really think about, is Krishna really God? Why am I distributing these books? Because I didn't have any experience of Krishna. I never felt any reciprocation. I just felt like I was being tortured out there in the airport. You know, it was horrible. But then gradually, you get some reciprocation from Paramatma, and okay, Krishna's God, I'll accept that, you know, but I still don't know what my personal unique relationship with Krishna is. So that doesn't get revealed until asakti. That's what Krishna says, maya sakta mana parta, asamshayam samagramam. At that stage of asakti, then you'll know me without doubts. And you could, because why? Your mind's attached to me. Why is your mind attached to me? Because there's no more doubts. So that's what we mean by doubts, not philosophical, like, I don't really believe there's a thing called jiva tattva, and, you know, not, that's just one out of many, 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 many types of doubts. Sri Devi.
Thank you, Mataji, for your very relevant class. So ultimately, we have to depend on mercy from the pure devotee, like you were saying, and also Krishna and Gauranga. So I think that that's the switch we constantly, or at least that's what I find in my struggle. We constantly have to switch our thinking from trying to analyze it with our mind to just focusing on trying to receive that mercy. And that's how what I've experienced is my doubts get eradicated, like through switching my mind.
And it's not just like a mechanical switch. What does it mean to get the mercy of a pure devotee? It's not like they just touch us with a peacock feather and all of a sudden my faith is increased. The mercy of the devotee comes in the form of them giving us the process of sadhana, like the second chapter of the Bhagavatam. It's scientifically outlining, verse by verse by verse, the different stages of sadhana. They're giving us the medicine. The doctor, what's the doctor's mercy on you? What's the doctor's mercy on you? The doctor gives you the medicine with the prescription, exactly how to take it. They give you the exercise. They give you the diet. Now you have to follow it. Hard work, 24/7 to follow a doctor's instructions. You got to remember what time to take the pills, what time to do this, and what time to do that, and don't do this, and don't do that. You got to be so strict. But if you follow their instructions, that's the mercy of the doctor. The doctor doesn't just touch you with a peacock feather and now you're all cured. So the pure devotees are giving us their mercy through their instructions. It's not magic. So, but we have to receive that mercy. I want to give you a big pile of money. You don't open your mouth to receive the money. There's a way to receive the gift. And when you receive the gift, you also have to open the package and look at the gift and take it out of the box and utilize it. What good is a gift if it's just sitting on the shelf collecting dust? So the pure devotees are giving us the gift, but have we accepted it? Or if we've accepted it, have we opened up the box and analyzed the contents? And if we've done that, have we actually put it to use? Or is it sitting on the shelf or in the garage? So we do the work. It's hard work to accept mercy. It's not that you just open your mouth and there's the mercy. It requires hard endeavor to receive the mercy properly. And it begins with our japa. Sorry, we're going over time here.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Yo quisiera preguntar, aquí la madre me va a traducir en inglés.
Okay.
Yo quisiera preguntarle qué es lo que Krishna manifiesta en el verso 9:26, que dice que el devoto debe preguntarle a Krishna, ¿qué quieres tú de mí? Eso quisiera que usted me podría explicar.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In the verse 9:26 in the Bhagavad Gita,
mm-hmm.
where the verse is, I want to ask if you can please explain to me where Krishna says in the verse that the devotee should ask Krishna, what do you want from me? Thank you, Mataji. That's my question.
All right, let's go to text 9:26. No, 9:26 is...
16.
Oh, 16?
Okay.
No, it's not 9:16 either. Anyway, I guess the Bhagavad Gita verse isn't known which one you're referring to, but the question was, Krishna asks sometimes the devotees, what do you want to do? Is that what you just said? I know Krishna says to Arjuna, now I have instructed you fully, deliberate on it fully, and do what you wish to do. In other words, we're always free. Love isn't forced. So that's the mercy. The mercy is that the instructions come. The process for following those instructions is given. The fruit of what those instructions would be are illustrated. We're given the empowerment and the ability to execute those instructions. But after hearing all that, Krishna says, deliberate on this fully, and then you decide. Do you want to accept the mercy, or do you not want to accept the mercy? I don't know if that addressed your question, but I think that's the verse you were referring to, perhaps, in Bhagavad Gita. If not, we can talk about it more later. Okay. Okay. One last thing that I'm mindful of.
A lot of times the word used, confidence, does confidence have a connection with doubt?
Okay. Confidence in Krishna is needed. Utsaran. Utsaha.
Yes.
Utsaran. What's the word? Dietet?
Nishchayat.
Confidence. Confidence that if I practice this path of bhakti yoga, I'm going to reach perfection. It's not confidence in myself. It's confidence in the process. It's confidence in the descending mercy. I'm confident that it can work for me. It's not that it only works for special people. But material confidence, you know, I have the ability to do something, or I have confidence in my wealth, my knowledge, you know, these kind of things, the false soldiers that I put up as my shelters, that kind of confidence. It means I have doubts. I have doubts about Krishna, so I put my shelter in my money, my family members, social security, you know, whatever. I have confidence in those things because I have doubts about Krishna.
Also, just one other aspect. You're talking about going to where Krishna's having his leela. Sometimes it's explained that this ISKCON is also Leela, and Prabhupada was in Leela with Krishna when he's here. So, and also, Prabhupada mentioned that you can go home in one lifetime.
Prabhupada said in this quote from the 10th canto, what does it mean to go back to Godhead in one lifetime? He said it means that such a perfect devotee, one who's perfected sadhana, he said, the devotee of the Lord returns home back to Godhead. This means that the devotee is first transferred to the particular universe where the Lord is at that time staying to exhibit his pastimes. That is back to Godhead. Could be Lord Chaitanya's Leela, could be Lord Krishna's Leela. I assume that also means Prabhupada's Leela, if devotees were to take birth where he's performing his Leela.
So I guess the question is this also part of Krishna, Lord Chaitanya's Leela, the Sankirtan movement?
If we realize it as such, right? If we realize that, then it is. But if we don't realize, I mean realize, not understand it theoretically or intellectually, but if one actually experiences that there's not just statues in our temple, then they are experiencing Leela. Such are the Uttama Bhaktas, right? Okay, we will end there. Thank you very much.